judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court's call to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Rodela, ACM number 20080. I note that today's argument is being conducted under the current COVID-19 pandemic mandates from the Department of Defense and other relevant authorities. Currently, the requirement in this building, and therefore this courtroom, is that all persons fully vaccinated are not required to don a mask. On the 5th of May of this year, this court granted appellant's motion for oral argument, and after restating the issue presented, today's oral argument will consider the following: whether appellant's conviction for abusive sexual contact in violation of Article 120 UCMJ is legally and factually insufficient because it was reasonable for appellant to believe the complaining witness consented to appellant's conduct by her response or lack thereof. I note that appellant's counsel is Mr. Hansel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. We'd wish to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. Mr. Hansel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Senior Judge Posh, Judge Richardson, Judge McGinley. May it please the court, my name is Mike Hansel. I represent the appellant, Airman Rodela, in this case. This case is about whether a person should be criminally liable if consent to touching is given and then taken away without any outward manifestation of that internal change of mind of the accuser. And put more specifically, for the facts and circumstances of this case and in comparison to how this court and its sister courts and how the CAF have analyzed mistake of fact in sexual offense cases, the question here is whether the government proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Airman Rodela could have had no objective and reasonable mistake of fact as to consent. And it's being analyzed under the framework of legal sufficiency and factual sufficiency. So our starting point in analyzing this case is the fact that MS, the accuser in this case, admittedly consented to a progression of touching. And that happened on two separate occasions on this particular evening where these accusations take place. She consented as it gradually became more and more intimate touching. And that's reflected in the record from about pages 89 to 110, where the trial defense counsel did a very good job of eliciting these details from her. But as it came out, and it's unambiguous in the record, Airman Rodela began by touching her over the clothes on her back, and then it progressed about a minute or two of kind of rubbing in that area, and then under the clothes on her back, and then around to the stomach under the clothes, before it actually touch her breasts, and then the touching stopped. She went to the bedroom, came back, and allowed him to touch her again on her back, over the clothes, then under the clothes for a minute or two, on her back, then around to the stomach under her clothes for a minute or two, before briefly touching her in the vulva area. She claims that she withdrew consent when the touching reached her breasts, then consented to the touching the second time from her back and progressing back through, but withdrew consent again when the touching reached her vulva.
What do you mean by withdrew consent?
Your Honor, what I mean by that is that she acknowledged that she consented to the touching that started on her back and then went under the clothes and then went around to her stomach. But what she testified to was that her consent stopped when the touching reached her breasts. So that's what I mean by withdrew consent, that she's acknowledged that she was consenting to touching, but then that consent went away.
So you look at it as a general consent to touch me anywhere, as opposed to a specific, yes, I'm consenting to touching my back.
Your Honor, I would view it as she was consenting to the touching that was happening at that time. And as he continued to progress in more intimate ways, because each sort of, you know, progression of touching from over the clothes to under the clothes, from the back to the stomach, became more and more intimate, she was consenting to those. And he would touch her, according to her testimony. This went on for about a minute or two each time. And so she was consenting to that specific touching, Your Honor. But she was indicating to him, because he was doing this for that period of time, you know, that was signaling to him, this is okay, because she made no indication to tell him otherwise. And the issue before the court now is that when she actually testifies that she did not consent, nothing changed about her behavior, either physically or verbally, that would indicate to him something's changed in terms of her mindset.
Is she required to manifest her consent somehow, and how did she in this case?
Your Honor, I don't believe she's required to manifest in terms of a verbal type expression, but I do think what we have is that she manifested her consent in the context of the relationship that these two had, which was that they'd been longtime friends. They knew each other very well. The record reflects that they were so close that they would spend the night in each other's barracks rooms in their apartments. And had been very close for the entire time they were stationed at Langley. So they knew each other as well as two friends would know each other. And so as he started touching her, and as she acknowledged she did consent to this touching, he would, as she testified, this would last for about a minute or two. And that was plenty of time for her, if she was uncomfortable with something, to indicate, no, I don't want this.
So the burden is on her to manifest a lack of consent?
Well, no, Your Honor, but I believe that what she was manifesting was that she was consenting to the touching by her actions, because she was acting in a way that would signal to him, I'm okay with this.
And that was my question. What were those actions?
So, Your Honor, I believe those actions were that as he was touching her, she basically was, by not responding in a negative way, showing him, I'm okay with this. And he would touch her for a lengthy period of time. 1 or 2 minutes is a long time. As she testified, that's how long each of these progressions went. And so that was an indication to him. That was a signal. However, when she testified, my consent stopped. I no longer consented when the touching reached my breasts or when it reached my vulva. Nothing changed about her behavior at all. There was no indication verbally. There was no indication physically that she had internally changed her mind. So it wasn't manifested in a way that he or any reasonable person would be able to interpret as something is different now.
In your brief, you state that any reasonable person who knew she was consenting to contact would believe that consent continued unless she manifested in some way, either physically or verbally, that she had changed her mind and was no longer consenting to being touched. How did he know she was consenting?
Yes, Your Honor. So our position is that he knew she was consenting because as the progression kind of went forward, he would touch her for a lengthy period of time. Again, you know, 1 to 2 minutes may sound, when I say it, not like much, but when you're looking at a clock, that's a long time. And so the fact that she gives no indication to him to stop, right, which within the context of their friendship, I think, you know, he knows her, she knows him. They can read each other's signs. The fact that she allows this, right, without giving any kind of negative indication, tells him, I'm okay with it. And we know she was, because she testified that way. So, you know, in terms of consent being an issue here, we don't believe that is the issue, because we know she consented. She testified that way to that touching. The issue is consent disappeared at a certain point. It was withdrawn. And the question there is, how would a reasonable person know that consent had been withdrawn when there's no change in behavior and there's no verbal signals, no physical or verbal signals to indicate the change? We know there was a change. The question is, how would a reasonable person have figured that out given the manifestations or lack thereof from the complaining witness in this case?
Well, how do you get over the hurdle of the fact that when he touches her vaginal area, she's essentially at the toilet puking or recovering? I mean, how do you overcome the reasonableness of what someone might think is an unreasonable behavior?
Yes, Your Honor, and you know, we understand that issue, and I think that's sort of the government's position, is that emotional response of would a person who is vomiting consent to anything? But I think the issue here is there might be, you know, many of us might say that much of the touching she actually did consent to. Maybe normally that wouldn't happen. But she did consent, right, to touching under the clothes, to touching around on the stomach. He knows her, she knows him. So
that's a good point. How much of the fact that their relationship plays into this? Because from my reading of the record, it looks like they're, quote unquote, in the friend zone, right?
Yes, sir.
There's no dating relationship. There's no indication that they'd had a previous sexual relationship. And so if he's touching back, maybe touching the stomach, okay, that may be what friends do. But he goes quite further than that by his own admission. Mm-hmm. So how do you explain the relationship aspect in this particular night, again, given the particular circumstances of where he's touching her in his apartment?
Yes, Your Honor. And so I think from a relationship standpoint, it does matter that they know each other as well as they do, that they're this close. You're correct that nothing in the record shows that there was a previous sexual relationship. However, I think, you know, from the facts of this case, the issue here is that the touching that she consented to that is reflected in this record progresses in an increasingly more intimate way, right? So even if there was no previous sexual relationship between the two of them, on this night, it's moving in a more intimate direction. And it's moving in a direction that I think a lot of people who were just in the friend zone wouldn't want, under the clothes, for example, you know, on the back. Even that, that's an intimate type of touch, and certainly under the clothes on the stomach is a more intimate touch, right? And from there, you know, to move up to the breast or move down to the vulva. So she has allowed him basically to do this, and she, you know, and it goes on for a while where, you know, I think in a normal sexual interaction where somebody tries to move it to the next level, which does happen, you know, this is giving someone a chance to, is this okay or is this not okay, right? And the indication is it is okay. And so he keeps on progressing it, right? So I think that's the issue in terms of the relationship. We agree that there was not a prior sexual relationship, but sexual relationships sometimes start, right, in this way. This is often how they start. And so, you know, I don't think that in terms of the fact that there wasn't a prior relationship, that impacts the issue that we're here to analyze.
Mr. Hansel,
yes, sir.
The Superior Court of ours, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, in McDonald talks about relatively recently too, the burden is on the actor, in this case would be your client, the burden is on the actor to obtain consent rather than the victim, mm-hmm. with the complaining witness, you know, to manifest non-consent. How do you reconcile that with the mistake of fact defense here? In other words, it seems like, as a hypothetical, that wouldn't it be the case if the victim says nothing, does nothing, manifests nothing, one way or the other, neither manifests consent, neither manifests non-consent, that doesn't help your client. Those are all facts that still help the government. But I'm trying to reconcile McDonald, and if your case is averse to McDonald in some way or another. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, Your Honor. So I guess I would have two points to kind of respond to the McDonald issue. So McDonald, McDonald is, you know, in the realm of the consent question, and I want to be careful not to conflate, you know, the issue here, which is mistake of fact as to consent, right, which is related but not exactly the same thing. So here in this case, the argument is about mistake of fact. McDonald is talking about whether there is consent. You know, from the record, we know that there was consent to that progression of touching that we've talked about because she has said there was. So that's not a disputed issue at this point, whether there was consent. We also know that because the way the touching took place with this increasingly more intimate progression, right, we know that you know, he's starting to touch her in a certain place, and he's reading the signal, because there's a signal there by her, you know, basically accepting that. That's a signal as well, especially in the context of, I think, the relationship they did have. And so I think that from that standpoint, one, we're not in the realm of consent, we're in the realm of mistake of fact, right? Two, we know she consented, right? And I think it's absolutely reasonable to interpret the fact that he, you know, touches her for as long as he does at each stage, gives her an opportunity to say, stop, to indicate somehow, I don't want this. And she doesn't do that, and that indicates consent. But the second piece is just that McDonald is so distinguishable. So, you know, one, I would say that, you know, some of what we're talking about here with McDonald is dicta from that case. But two, that is a case where an Army private basically, his roommate was having sex with a female. The roommate steps aside and he just walks up and has sex with her with kind of no, you know, there's nothing before that, right? That was the McDonald case where the court is saying in dicta, you know, you do have some obligation to obtain consent here, right? This isn't that case, because in this case, it's not like he, you know, surprises her. She doesn't know it's him. He goes straight to the sexual action. In this case, it's very different, because she knows it's him. She knows who she's with. And he starts with the less intimate touching, and progressively it becomes more intimate. Much different scenario, I think, than McDonald.
So here's kind of my concern, though, about the mistake of fact. And of course, the government has the burden to disprove mistake of fact beyond a reasonable doubt. And of course, mm-hmm. that's settled law. But what I'm wondering is, what exactly is the mistake of fact? Is the mistake of fact that this was a members' trial and this was not, and if there were instructions, and of course there were none, because mm-hmm. it's a judge-alone trial. But if there weren't members and the judge was charging the members with the law of mistake, is it that the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused did not labor under mistaken belief of consent, or is it a mistaken belief that consent had been given? Because it seems like it's not mistake of fact as to consent, it's as to whether consent had been obtained or whether it had been given. Or is that a poor reading of the mistake of fact element that's here?
Your Honor, our position would be that what the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt was that Airman Rodella, under these circumstances, had no reasonable and objective mistake of fact as to her having consented to the touching, right? That's how we would view it. And so the government has this burden of proving beyond reasonable doubt that, you know, this mistake of fact could not have existed in his mind, and or that it would not be reasonable, right? You know, and our position is, based on the record here, that they failed to do that, because we have this situation where we know that she did consent to touching that immediately preceded the touching in question. And at that point, you know, she changes her mind, but she doesn't indicate to him at all, right? And so essentially, the standard that's being created, if this court accepts that, is the standard, instead of how a reasonable person might react to that situation, it's of a mind reader, right? Of, you know, setting a standard where you have to be a mind reader. We know human interaction, sexual interaction, it's, you know, and the law doesn't require this, that you ask at every stage, can I touch you here? Can I touch you here? Can I touch you here? That's just not reality, and it's not the law. And in this case, he didn't ask at every stage. Instead, what he did was he would linger at a certain area in a certain way for 1 to 2 minutes. That's plenty of opportunity, right, in his mind. Is there consent? Yes, there is. And now I'm going to move forward a bit, which is how human sexuality often works in the real world. And then at a certain point, he moves forward, and she testifies and says, I didn't consent to that, but there was no indication of it. So from the standpoint of the government proving beyond a reasonable doubt that he did not harbor that reasonable, objective mistake of fact, that's where our position is, that the government failed to meet that element, to knock that out. Instead, there is a reasonable doubt about that at the very least. And certainly this court shouldn't create a standard where you have to read a mind, where you have to be able to interpret when there's no outward signs at all, either you know, verbal or physical signs that there wasn't consent. And I think that, you know, kind of is illustrated by how this court and other courts have viewed mistake of fact in the case law, which has been cited to. And I'll talk about that briefly.
I want to talk about the definition of consent in the UCMJ.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which includes that lack of verbal or physical resistance does not constitute consent. But isn't that exactly the premise of your argument, is that because he was touching her for 1 to 2 minutes and she did not indicate any verbal or physical resistance, that she must have been consenting, because of course he's not a mind reader?
No, Your Honor, the premise of our argument is that we know she was consenting because she has said that on the record.
But he didn't know that. She never told him in any way, shape, or form that she was consenting to any one of those touches.
And yes, Your Honor, our position is that he did have an indication of that because of their relationship and because of the way this played out in sort of, you know, within this interaction. The issue now, though, we're past the issue of consent from our view, because she's acknowledged that there's consent.
She acknowledged that after the fact, she said what was on her mind, which was, yeah, I was fine with the back touching. I thought the stomach touching was kind of weird, but it didn't raise a red flag, and I was concentrating on vomiting. And that she never consented to the breast or the vulva touch. So, yes, after the fact, she says she's consenting, but how is it reasonable for him to believe that she was consenting or that he had obtained consent if she gave no outward sign at all?
And, Your Honor, our position on that, again, is that, yes, after the fact at trial, she testified, but she was testifying about how she felt during the time. And she was saying, at that time, I consented to him initially touching me on the back, shoulders area, over my clothes. I consented when it went under my shirt and it became skin to bare skin on my back. When it went around in my stomach, yeah, it was a little weird, but I there was no red flags. I consented to that, right?
But to follow up to Judge Richardson's comment, mm-hmm. how did he know that she was consenting?
Yes, Your Honor. And so, you know, our position there is that he knew, based on the relationship that they had and based on the reactions or lack thereof that he got. And I understand the court's position in terms of saying, but when we analyze consent, you know, we want more than just an absence. But the issue is, here in this case, there was consent. He knew how to read her and she knew how to read him because of their longstanding friendship. And so he knew there was consent at that time, based on that and based on, you know, giving her the chance to indicate to him if there was some difference there in her mind. She did not do that, but all that was reflecting was the consent that she's acknowledging existed. So, in other words, there was consent, you know, and the issue of, you know, kind of examining him knowing it, we get past that when we know that there was consent. And so now the issue is, how would he know that that consent wasn't there? And that's really, I think, how this court should view this, is how do we know that the consent, which we know existed because the record is very unambiguous about that, disappeared? How would a reasonable person understand that? And that's where the case law comes in, because the way this court analyzes and has analyzed in recent cases, as well as sister courts and as well as the CAF, reasonable mistake of fact, we look at several cases that have come out within the last year. Brunson, Crump, so December 2020, November 2020 from this court. And what we see when they analyze reasonable mistake of fact, when this court has done it, is they look at what signals showed that this person wasn't consenting that the reasonable person would have received, right? So they're not looking at it the other way around. They're looking at it like that, and they're saying in Brunson, you know, this was a case where they met that day, right? It wasn't a long-standing relationship where somebody might be able to read signals from someone else. They just met that day.
So what was the signal for him to be able to go down her pants?
Well, Your Honor, I think it was, again, that this kind of the progression of touching, the more and more intimate progression of touching, right, where at each stage, you know, he does it for a few minutes and it's fine, right? And so then he moves forward to the next, right? And again, That is, I would say, how a lot of human sexuality works in real life, right? We don't consider that to be sexual assault or a sexual offense when people kind of increasingly move in intimate ways. That's not how the real world works, and I don't believe that's how the law works. And so in the case law, that's how it's been analyzed, right? That's how it was analyzed in Brunson. They looked at, she moved away from him. She
but
indicated,
are those acts required? Or were those just factors that made the government's case stronger?
I think those were required, Your Honor. The way those courts looked at it, including this court, and I say I don't have too much time, but quickly, you know, the analysis is very similar in Crump from this court, where, again, they looked at, you know, verbal and physical manifestations, and this was without having consensual touching beforehand, right? And it's similar with CAF's analysis of Prasad, and it's similar in Drinkert, which is the case the government indicated, where actually, you know, the indications of lack of consent were pretty significant, very different from this case. And so I have a little bit, about a minute left. And so barring any more questions, I'll conclude for now and then come back on rebuttal. But our position in this case is that a reasonable person, especially, you know, two 20-year-olds that we're talking about here, is not a mind reader. And people should not be expected to ask permission for each touch. That's not how the real world works. It's not how the law has worked. There's an emotional argument that somebody was throwing up and therefore they wouldn't consent. But in reality, people throw up and then consent to a lot of things after, including sexual activity, including other things. And so the issue here is when she changes her mind, what indicators would there be, physical or verbal, to a reasonable person that would say the mind has been changed? And there was none in this case, and that's why we asked that the conviction and the sentence be set aside in this case. Barring any questions, I will.
Thank you, Mr. Hansel.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Major Delaney, are you prepared to proceed?
I am, yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. Appellant's own words were, when she was kind of just on the bowl, and I think she was resting on the bowl, I was like, that's really gross. That was my only thought. That's really gross. And then when he addresses later the thought process he had going on in his mind while he was touching MS's breasts and vagina, he says, I was having a battle with myself at that point. One is saying, no, stop. Either just stay on her stomach or just keep her propped up so she doesn't fall over. This court should affirm the findings in this case as legally and factually sufficient, as the government both proved the two elements of abusive sexual contact, and there was no mistake of fact defense in this case. Now, I'd like to begin by addressing questions that each of the judges asked, going toward what was appellant's mistake of fact in this case? What was he confused about? And this is where the record does not support the argument that appellant tries to make on appeal, because mistake of fact must be both honest in his mind and objectively reasonable. And the reason that appellant cannot tell this court why he had a mistaken understanding is because that evidence is contradicted by what appellant himself said. The record demonstrates that he did not have a subjective belief that MS was consenting to the conduct at issue. First, you have his statements to OSI, in which he repeatedly acknowledges that the touching in the case, so the touching is the back rubbing, not sexual contact, but rubbing of the back while a friend is throwing up. He says that started as innocent to comfort her. So even in his own mind, there is no sexual intimacy in him rubbing her back. When he addresses her point of mind while he's rubbing her, he says, her face is on the toilet and I knew she wasn't okay and she would think that were gross if she were okay and that's why I'm pulling her back from the toilet. That's what he thinks she is thinking as he's touching her. He doesn't think that she's consenting to sexual activity. He thinks that she is in such dire straits that she is resting her face on the toilet bowl, which he himself says she wouldn't want to do because that's what my butt touches. There are the statements that he makes in the pretext conversation after OSI interviews MS, in which he claims to not remember anything that happened that night. And that's consciousness of his understanding that his touching was without consent, because of course we know, because he states in great detail to OSI what happens, that he does remember. He's pretending not to remember because he knows, and he knew in that moment, that what he was doing was a crime. He mentioned having to prop her up. He mentioned her not being able to support her weight. And not once in his two statements to OSI or his written statement or to MS himself does he ever state that he believed that she was consenting to him touching her breast or vagina. On the reasonable side, of course, it's objectively not reasonable that while she is actively throwing up in a relationship that has never had a sexual component to it, that he somehow had consent to touch her breasts or her vagina. Judge Richardson, you went to the statutory definition of consent, and that's really what's at issue here. It's a freely given consent to the conduct at issue, and the conduct at issue is the touching of the breast and the vagina. And there was never any consent given to that touching. Appellant can't point to one single iota of evidence to support a manifestation of consent to the sexual touching that is the conduct at issue. And he can't even point to a manifestation of consent to the back touching. Now, it's not a crime because of the fact that she consented to it, but in his mind, which is what the mistake of fact defense goes toward, there is nothing to indicate in his mind that any of the touching is consensual. But again, agree with appellant that that was not a crime. It's not charged as a battery. That's not here. What's charged is the vaginal touching and the breast touching, to which there is no indication that she has ever given consent. And the fact that she did not, that there was a lack of verbal or physical resistance, does not mean that she did not consent and cannot mean in his mind that he had consent. Appellant stated in his argument that nothing changed in her behavior between the touching on her back and the touching of her vaginal area and her breasts. And of course there was no change, because what does she say? She says, as he's touching her stomach, I was busy throwing up, my throat was burning, I thought it was weird. As he moves to her breast, what does she say? My face was still in the toilet bowl. Are you still throwing up at this time? The trial counsel asks, and she says, I'm sure I was. Appellant is asking that while someone is throwing up in a toilet bowl, they are required to tell a person, hold on now, I don't want you to touch my breast while I'm actively throwing up. That's not the law. That's not supported by any case law. It's not supported by the RCMs, and it's not supported by the definition of consent. And then, of course, as appellant is touching her vagina, what she testifies is, my head is still in the toilet. Are you actively throwing up? I believe so, yes. That's not an emotional argument that a reasonable person would not believe they had consent. That is a reasonable, objective indication that a person is not in the condition to consent and that they would not consent to sexual activity with someone they have never engaged in any romantic relationship with while actively throwing up. Appellant's counsel stated, this is often how sexual relationships start. Sexual relationships do not often start with one party actively throwing up in the toilet. For these reasons, not only was there no objectively reasonable mistake of fact in the case, but there was not even a subjective evidence to raise the mistake of fact defense. Barring any further questions from this court, under a factual and legal sufficiency standard, this court should affirm the findings in the case.
We would also like your position on the language that Senior Judge Posh quoted from McDonald. What does that mean? The burden is on the actor to obtain consent rather than the victim to manifest a lack of consent. Appellant says that that's dicta.
Your Honor, it's not dicta. It's a reaffirmation of long settled case law that sexual assault has its general intent component, which is that the victim has control over whether she consents or not. That's the law. It does not, nowhere in the statute does it say he must have obtained her consent when he knew she did not consent. That's the affirmative defense, which is separate and apart from the actual crime of sexual assault itself. Now, it goes toward the mistake of fact in the sense that it is one factor to consider. But yes, when it comes to sexual assault cases, the burden is on him to have an understanding that he has consent, because he cannot raise a mistake of fact defense if he does not believe that he has consent.
Mitch Delaney, the practitioners that have been doing this for a long time, we do speak in terms of mistake of fact defense, and we speak in terms of mistake of fact as to consent. Mistake of fact as to whether the complaining witness consented. And for those who have been doing this for a very long time, the Article 120, we've seen it change. And as we can remark, when judges on this panel were captains, the Article 120, which was rape, was worded in such a manner that we looked to see if the victim resisted, so to speak. And I can't do much more than paraphrase from not a terribly good memory, but very much of the focus was on the victim and whether the victim resisted. And then we asked questions, well, maybe the victim couldn't resist because of alcohol or surrounding circumstances and the like. But the mistake of fact, the instruction has not changed, not in the bench book. And as far as I can recall from McDonald, it seems as if the CAF recently said that the mistake of fact instruction that was given in that case was good. But what I wonder is, if you have thoughts as to whether the mistake of fact instruction is it were read in terms of the definition of consent under the new Article 120, if you will, whether it's really a mistake of fact as to whether the individual, the accused, reasonably believed that the victim manifested consent, or it seems like there should be an action verb somewhere with the word consent that we're leaving out. In other words, consent, it seems the definition says it has to be a freely given agreement, it has to be given by somebody. In McDonald, the CAF sometimes talks in terms of giving consent, the victim giving consent, or the complaining mm-hmm. witness giving consent, and sometimes in terms of the accused obtaining consent. Those may be equivalent, maybe not. But I'm wondering if the mistake of fact is really whether the individual is mistaken as to whether consent was obtained or given, and not just consent in general. In other words, this is not a mind reading game. This is a focus on what manifestations, if any, are such that mistake of fact goes to the obtaining of consent or the giving of consent. If you have any thoughts on that.
Your Honor, I believe that the element, right, so when we're looking at mistake of fact, you're correct. We colloquially speak to it as mistake of fact as to consent, but the RCMs just talk about mistake of fact generally. So we have to look to the statute to determine what actual element at issue he would have been mistaken as to. And in the current iteration of 120, there's only the two elements, the sexual act or the consent. And the statute does not talk about giving or obtaining consent. It just says with or without consent. So I think the mistake still has to go toward that factual determination of, is there consent? Now, as a practical matter, the only way in which a person knows whether they have consent is that manifestation of it. And that's where we have this kind of difference between the mistake of fact that goes toward the victim's state of mind and then the mistake of fact defense under RCM 916 that looks solely at the accused's state of mind. So it's in that analysis of his mistake of fact that we look to whether he had obtained it, because that's a fact and circumstance. What she told him is a fact and circumstance to determine whether his understanding was honest, subjectively, and reasonable on the other hand. But this court should not hold that there is some affirmative requirement in the statute that the government has to prove in assessing whether there is or is not consent in a case.
Yeah, I will ask this one. I know this was a judge alone case, but in the appellant's brief, he cites the instructions that would have been given, and that got me thinking, whether the mistake was reasonable be something that's put to the fact finder, or is that something judge can find. That is, he can find that there is no iota of evidence supporting a reasonable belief. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, Your Honor. We've actually discussed that quite a bit in our office. On the first prong, whether the actual mistake of fact in his mind has been raised, that's something that a judge certainly can say there is no evidence to support him subjectively having had this belief. And we know that judges have refused to give an instruction based on that. The objective reasonable prong is a little bit more difficult. Now, in this case, as we've seen, appellant can't point to something in the record that any reasonable person could rely upon. So I think in this case, it's a close call. Most of the cases that we see, there's something. But in this case, there's no pre-existing relationship. There's no manifestation of consent, even to the rubbing of the back. There's her pulling a sports bra down after he's touched her breast. So to the extent that she's capable of saying she doesn't consent, she does in this case. And she says, you know, I did as much as I could. I was busy throwing up. I felt like I couldn't move. But I think that's a very close call, Your Honor, and I don't think it's one that needs to be reached in this case. I would recommend leaving that to the trial judges to adjudicate at that level. Barring any further questions, the government requests that this court affirm the findings.
Thank you, Major Delaney. Mr. Hansel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So I'll hit a few points that were just talked about in the government's argument. First of all, the government talked a little bit about that basically the defense's position is that if your face is in the toilet bowl, you still have to tell someone. That's not the defense's position. Our position here in this case is that in a situation where there is consent, which we know there is, that there's got to be some indication that that consent has been taken away for a reasonable person to understand that that has happened. You know, and that I think is a general rule that there should be some indication where that we know there is consent for a reasonable person to then know that that no longer exists. The government talked about, and I think some of the questions from the court about, the circumstances of this where, you know, as the government said, her face was in toilet bowl and she couldn't do anything, but she could, and she acknowledged that in the record on cross-examination. She talked about, and the defense counsel asked her, you know, there were various things you did at various times where you made decisions, you flushed the toilet, you moved in certain ways, right? That, and she acknowledged, yeah, I could have moved away. I could have indicated, you know, I had control of myself. This is not a tonic immobility case or some kind of case where there's incapacitation. That's not this case. This case is one where she had the ability to express herself and it just didn't happen, that there was any expression of what she's claiming in her mind occurred. I'll note also in the context of kind of, you know, as the government saying this was completely, you know, not a sexual type of environment, you know, we have to take into account the context of in between the two different progressions of touching, what happened and what happened afterwards, which is that they went back and were on the bed together. And afterwards, they cuddled in bed in a spooning position, according to the record, for the rest of the night, right? So this is what immediately happens afterwards, and this is what's sort of happening in between the two different allegations of non-consensual sexual touching. And I think that does matter in terms of viewing the context of kind of this overall situation. The government talks a lot about kind of the consent issue. And again, you know, our position is that we need to be careful not to conflate consent versus mistake of fact. And that, you know, they're in court, and as the question from the court to the trial counsel about what is the military judge's responsibility in these types of situations, there's an instruction that would be given to members and it would cover consent and reasonable mistake of fact. And the test really was some evidence raised, whether credible or not. It's below the standard of probable cause. It's the lowest standard we have. Was there some evidence of an, you know, that would warrant an instruction, in this case, you know, a, say, a mistake of fact instruction. That's what our position is in terms of, you know, it would be for the fact finder to determine, which would be members or judge, depending on who the fact finder was. But the standard there in terms of whether that is in play is, was there some evidence, right? And so that's the lowest standard that we have.
So let's say there is some evidence. How the government failed to meet its burden specifically, especially in light of appellant's interview to OSI, where he does say her face and her arm was on the toilet, and I thought that was gross. Mm-hmm. And you make this progression when he says, yeah, I see what's going on. She's throwing up in the toilet. I think this is gross. To a very short time later thinking, all right, I've got the green light to touch her. That's a quite, that's a very fast progression in my mind, given that there was no relationship, no sexual relationship with this prior. So how did the government fail to meet its own burden in light of even appellant's own testimony, or not testimony, but own statement to OSI?
Mm-hmm. Well, and Your Honor, when we talk about that burden, then, you know, the burden for an instruction, some evidence, the government's burden here is beyond a reasonable doubt, the highest burden in the law, to prove that this didn't happen in terms of a mistake, a reasonable objective mistake of fact. And, you know, our position is the government failed to meet that burden because once there was consent, so again, it's the starting point of kind of how we view it that's important here. The starting point in our position should be once there has been consent and we know that there's consent, which we do know from the record, at that point, then has the government shown that he reasonably would have known that consent no longer existed? See, my time is just about expired here, but in terms of answering that question, that's how the government failed to meet its burden, because they've presented nothing to basically, you know, to meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that shows a reasonable person would have been able to understand when her mind had changed. There's nothing from the government on that. That is their burden, and they do have a burden of beyond a reasonable doubt to basically rebut that defense. And if there, I think my time is moving up now, so I think I've exceeded it. But
your liberty. I think Judge Richardson has a question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
What we've looked at the video. We've looked at the 1168. We've looked at the text messages. What is the evidence that his belief was that he actually had an honest belief that she was consenting to him touching her breasts?
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand, you know, he didn't testify, and so there's kind of a limited amount that we have from this record in terms of his subjective state of mind, and OSI didn't really ask a lot of questions about, they focused more on where he touched and really didn't do a very good job of focusing on intent. So I think we have to look at the circumstances, and we have to look at the actual situation, and I think the evidence for that comes from the fact that, again, He, as this was happening, you know, goes over and is touching her in ways, given the friendship relationship that they already had, given kind of the signals that they would have known how to read from each other, and given that, you know, that he's taking time and giving her an opportunity to respond to it and reading her responses, that's where we can interpret that from the record, Your Honor. And so I believe, you know, that shows that, and it's corroborated by her that, you know, there was consent at that point. He understood that, and that's why he continues to kind of progress it, because he sees, I've got consent here, I'm going to progress a little further. And then he sees, I've got consent here, I'm going to progress a little further. So that's where I would say that comes from, Your Honor.
You may briefly conclude, Mr. Hansel.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. In conclusion, again, we would say that the standard here should not be that the reasonable person has to read the mind of an accuser, complaining witness. The standard should be that there has to be some indication of, if once consent has already been given, and that's what differentiates this from so many of the other cases, once consent has already been given, there's got to be some manifestation that's been withdrawn for a reasonable person to understand that. And that's why the reasonable mistake of fact should have resulted in this not being a conviction. Therefore, we asked this court to set aside the conviction and the sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Hansel and Major Delaney, counsel for both sides, thank you for your arguments. This court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.